I don't exactly believe him. Not completely, at least. But he didn't hurt me last night. And that's something. Perhaps I can find my way out of here before he changes his mind. The wall, however, proves impossible. Though I feel up and down and along the floors from side to side, I can't find even a hairline crack to indicate where an opening might be. I start to tremble. Sweat beads my brow. Am I trapped? Entombed? No. There must be a way out. There must be. What was it my dark bridegroom said last night? Speak your will and it shall be done, I whisper. Taking a step back, I contemplate the wall, chewing the inside of my cheek, then back up a few paces, eyes narrowing. Could it really be so simple? Open, I say, my voice quavering only slightly. At once, the door slides open. I don't see how it's done. There's no ripple in the stone, scarcely a creak. One moment there's a solid wall in front of me, the next, a door. I let out a short breath. Incredible. Yet also terrible somehow. I don't feel any magic in my blood, yet magic responded to my voice, my command. It's a strange sensation. Is it because I possess his name? Aralas, I speak silently, forming the word with my lips, but uttering no sound. Once more, I feel that shimmering power in the air around me, that sense of strength I don't understand but cannot deny. This knowledge is powerful indeed, and dangerous. Could I use it against him? Could I leverage it in my favor? Maybe, but how? Shelving that thought for future consideration, I step into the doorway and peer out. A white stone passage awaits. Tall, color-stained windows line the far wall, and doors line the other. The windows are as elaborate as the one in my room, depicting scenes. Men and women, lords and ladies, monsters, seas, castles, clouds. Far too much to take in with a single glance. I step from my room into the passage, wrapping my arms around my middle. The doors and windows are so tall, I feel altogether dwarfed in comparison. My clothes are poor and thin, my feet bare. If anyone were to catch me creeping around in a place like this, they'd mistake me for a sneak thief for sure. The passage seems just as long in both directions, so I turn to the right and set off at a trot. The doors along the wall are all shut fast, and I don't bother trying to open them. Funny that I can see them on this side of the wall. Once inside the chambers, do these doors vanish into the wall like in my own room? The corridor ends abruptly at an arch hung with diaphanous curtains. Pulling these gently aside, I look out into an open courtyard surrounded by a pillared colonnade. The walls all around are 3 stories high at least, but bright sky vaults overhead, its blue unimpeded by any canopy. Little white clouds trail into my line of vision. A huge table stretches down the center of the courtyard, lined with dozens of chairs, each elaborately carved from a single block of stone and set with plump cushions. The table itself is shaped like a huge beast, with monstrous legs and great clawed feet that seem to plunge into the ground itself, gripping fast. I wouldn't be surprised to see it suddenly rear up and roar. I hesitate, half hiding behind a pillar. Something tickles my nose, a delicious aroma. Turning my head, I see that the far end of the table is set with gold flatware. Tall-footed platters hold elaborate displays of fruit I don't recognize. But the smell is one I know quite well, fresh-baked bread. My stomach growls. Its rumble unexpectedly loud in that open space. I wince and suck in both lips, biting down hard. Gods above, how hungry I am. How long has it been now since I last ate? Is this meal intended for my shadowy bridegroom? I glance up and down the courtyard, searching for a glimpse of him. But no. He said I couldn't see him. For some mysterious reason of his own. Does this mean he won't be joining me for meals? A small comfort under the circumstances, but I'm grateful anyway. Perhaps this meal is meant for me. I take one step from behind the pillar. Then I jump back, startled, when a strange figure appears at the other end of the courtyard. It's a woman, unmistakably a woman. She's completely naked from head to toe and completely green except for a creamy stripe from her chin down between her small breasts to her navel. Her skin's texture appears rather leathery. Her body is shaped like those weird, elongated forms I glimpsed last night, with arms that reach below her knees. She moves with a fluid grace, long antenna wafting gently from her head amid a cloud of thick, dark green curls, like the tendrils of a vine. In one hand, she carries a covered platter, which she balances over her head as she glides silkily to the end of the table where the meal is set. She places her platter among the others and lifts the lid. An ululating cry of rage bursts from her lips. The lid drops from her fingers and hits the floor with a ringing clang. I give a start and duck back behind the curtain, but peer out again the next moment as the green woman's cries echo about the courtyard. A little creature lies in the center of her tray. Long, twiggy fingers hold up what looks like a stuffed pastry, which it brings daintily to its lips, taking tiny, precise bites with huge brown buck teeth. Like the green woman, he is utterly naked, every bit of his scrawny manhood shamelessly displayed for all to see. His ears are huge and pointed like two bat wings, and his nose is nearly as long as one of his bony little arms. He blinks large eyes up at the green woman and takes another unhurried bite. She shrieks and takes a swipe at him. Somehow he contrives to go from a lounging sprawl to an upward spring with no discernible transition, dodging the blow and cackling with delight. The green woman hisses, displaying a ferocious set of sharp white teeth. Snatching the now empty platter off the table, she swings it at the little man. He dodges this just as easily, lands on the table, and bounds down the length of it, hopping like a rabbit rather than running. The green woman pursues him, her yodeling voice echoing among the pillars. The two of them disappear between the columns at the far end of the courtyard, swishing through another set of curtains. I clutch the pillar, my eyes so wide they're stinging. At least now I know I'm not alone in this house with my shadowy bridegroom. What are these folk exactly? His servants? Were they among the people who stole me away last night? My gaze drifts back to the food, and my stomach grumbles again. I feel hollow inside, weak. Could I safely dart out and snatch some of that bread or one of those strange fruits before the weird folk return? Almost unconsciously, my muscles tense, my feet bracing for a quick sprint. But what if it's a trap? I stop. My hands tighten on the pillar. I've heard stories, of course. So many stories of human girls whisked away by mad fey lovers, lost in the depths of fairyland, only to return to their families decades later, unaged and dripping with jewels. It doesn't happen often these days, not since the signing of the pledge established peace between humans and fey, but the stories linger on. I've never paid much attention. My life offers no time for stories, either horrible or fantastic. I rise before dawn to labor through the long day, then collapse soon after sunset with barely enough energy between times to provide a little comfort for Brielle. I have never attended the village dances or joined the throng in the village square when a traveling storyteller passed through. Nevertheless, I seem to recall a detail. Something that had worked its way into my subconscious. To eat from the bounty of a fey lord's table always spelled disaster for the unwary maid. Somehow, accepting his food meant accepting the fey himself. Many a maid lost her freedom and virtue because she could not control her appetites. I place a hand across my cavernously hollow stomach. Who can say whether such stories are history or fancy or something in between? Best not to risk it. I must find a way out of here. Something moves across the courtyard. I turn quickly, half retreating behind the pillar again. Is it the green woman and the little man returning from their chase? No. The courtyard is still and silent, other than a distant sound of running water coming from somewhere unseen. There seems to be no one about. Then a shadow peels away from the deeper shadows cast by the pillars across from me. For an instant, I see the dark silhouette of a tall, broad-shouldered man. My heart lurches. Has my bridegroom come for his meal? The shadow vanishes and reappears farther down the courtyard, flashing against pillars and disappearing between them. It moves away from me. I frown, caught in a moment of indecision. Then, though I'm not entirely certain why, I creep out from behind the curtains and hurry after the shadow, skirting the table and following at a distance of 10 yards. My bare feet make no sound on the cool tiles, and I take care that not even a loud breath gives me away. My eyes search carefully, swiveling among the pillars and over the long table. But I spy no sign of who might actually cast this shadow. Only the shadow itself. It leads to the far end of the courtyard and slips under the colonnade. Another curtained arch waits there, and the curtains waft gently. Stirred by a breeze? Or did the shadow disturb them when it passed through? I firm my jaw and hurry after, parting the curtains carefully. A huge space spreads before my view. At first, it seems so large. I wonder if I've stepped outside. On second glance, I see that walls frame a large hall lined with windows and sheltered by an arched ceiling high overhead, painted in fantastical images of clouds and gods and airy beings. The floor is inlaid with precious and semi-precious stones, lapis lazuli and garnet and jasper and others I don't recognize, forming stunning floral patterns that branch from each other in ever more complex displays. Tall statues line either side of the space. 4 times the size of even the tallest man, they are carved with such lifelike precision one almost expects them to step down from their pedestals and move and speak together. There are 7 in total, 3 on one side, 3 on the other. The 7th and final statue stands at the far end of the hall. I draw a sharp breath. In my world, it's considered blasphemous to create graven images of the gods. Yet I would recognize these holy figures anywhere. Tanator and Tanil, Elowin and Lamruel, Nornala and Wyrm. I name them by turn. And the great goddess, Anarin, mother of all. It's a chapel, this magnificent space, so lofty, so light, is a chapel to the gods. My gods. It's strange somehow to realize that the Fae, or this Fae, at least, this Lord Damaris, worships the same gods I do. He's so strange, so other, his world so removed from mine. But are we really that different after all? The sight of those beautiful faces carved in red stone is almost too much, too overwhelming. My head swims, and I want to draw back from the arch, back into the courtyard. I have the ridiculous fear that any movement of mine will draw those hard stone eyes my way, so I stay where I am, frozen. Then my eye lands on a shadow before the altar of the great goddess. At first, it seems insignificant, and I almost turn away. Then it moves, and I fix my gaze on it to better discern what is there. But there's nothing to discern. Just a shadow. A tall shadow with no body to cast it. It kneels before the altar. As I watch, 2 arms lift as though in supplication. Then the shadow doubles over as though crumpling onto its face. Something about that sight is so horrible, so abject. Suddenly finding my will to move, I let the curtain fall and leave behind the magnificent chapel. My heart thuds painfully, and I clench my fists, my brow tightening into a frown. What did I just witness in there? I shake my head and turn away. I need to get out of here, need to find my way home somehow. That should be, must be, my only concern. My pulse is jumpy and my skin prickles with nerves. I half expect strange figures to appear from behind the pillars as I retreat. I don't want to return to my own rooms, so I choose at random another passage leading from the courtyard. It, too, is lined with doors on one side and windows on the other. But at the end, I see an open window not paned with colored glass. I hasten toward it, hoping to at last have a look at the world beyond the walls of this great house. A fresh wind blows in my face as I draw near, and the sound of running water intensifies. I slow, suddenly afraid of what I'll see on the other side. Perhaps I don't want to know, but what good will cowardice do me now? I shake my head, clench my teeth, and make myself continue, make myself look out. My vision swims. The house stands atop a huge block of stone many stories above churning white water. The water flows swiftly, pouring out over the brink of a massive cliff. From this vantage, I can't see the end of the waterfall, only mist. But beyond the brink, a vast expanse of wide, wild landscape stretches out before me, so far away it might belong to another world entirely. Though a midday sun shines overhead, that faraway land is bathed in silvery moonlight. The wind blows cold spray into my face. I unconsciously wipe it away and continue to stare. Horror slowly swells inside me, and I can't stop it. I'm not sure I want to. Finally, I pry my fingers free of the stone sill and back away from the window. The truth slams into me like a blow from behind, buckling my knees. I sag, sink to the floor, and only just manage to catch myself, to keep from falling flat on my face. There's no denying it, no resisting reality. I'm trapped, trapped in this house, trapped in this world, far from everything and everyone I've ever known. And there's no way out. Not until my monster bridegroom decides to let me go. How long I remain sitting in the middle of that corridor, I can't say. My body is numb, my mind immobile. At some point, the naked green woman finds me. Long, large-jointed fingers wrap around my shoulders from behind, and a crooning, burbling voice speaks softly in my ear. I sniff loudly and turn to look into that odd face with its flickering antenna and those huge black eyes. It's a horrible sight, like something out of a nightmare. And yet the expression is tender despite its strangeness, gentle and full of concern. The voice burbling through those thin lips and sharp teeth sounds almost maternal. I don't understand you, I say when the voice speaks something that ends with a questioning lilt. Don't you speak my language? No, you must. My stomach twists, bitter bile churning in my gut. I heard you and the others, last night, outside my door. You promised gold and you. I grimace and shoot a glare at the woman from under my lowered brows. You said you had my sister. The green woman tilts her head, the motion sharp and bird-like. Her dark eyes blink slowly, one after the other. Then she burbles some more and tugs at my shoulders, urging me to rise. There's subtle power in that grasp. I suspect she could pick me up and toss me over her shoulder with hardly a thought, if she so desires. Not wishing to see this theory proven, I scramble to my feet, straightening my skirts. The green woman chirrups happily and waves an arm, gesturing down the hall. It's either do as I'm told or be forced like a prisoner. I turn and walk purposefully back the way I came, I stop when I reach the courtyard, not because I don't know where to go, but because I don't relish the idea of returning to my room. But where else can I go? What else can I do? Beckoning with hands and antenna alike, the green woman urges me toward the head of the table where the meal is still set. I plant my feet and shake my head. No, I will rest now. She pauses. Then, with a gesture that might have been a shrug, she motions again. I follow her around the table and back through the curtained arch. We walk down the hall of windows, stepping through pools of colored light cast on the floor. The Fae woman's skin transforming from green to purple to red to gold by turns. She keeps up a steady stream of burbling chatter all the way. I don't bother trying to understand. At last, we reach what must be my door. The green woman waves her hand, and it opens. I look inside, see the huge sleigh bed, the upholstered chair, the fireplace. My room. My room. I shudder. I don't want anything about this house to be mine. Thank you, I say stiffly and step inside. When the green woman makes as though to follow, I put up a quick hand. I wish to be alone. The antenna twitch, rubbing against one another thoughtfully as the woman tilts her head from one side to the other. With a last burble, she sweeps a graceful bow and glides off up the corridor, casting several looks over her shoulder as she goes. I wait until she's out of sight. Then I back into the room, look at the wall, and say quietly, "Close." The door shuts. The wall becomes solid stone. I'm closed into my tomb. My nice, safe tomb. On unsteady legs, I move to the chair by the hearth and sink into it. My heart is heavy. My spirit's numb. I'm right back where I started that morning, only now with the added knowledge that I'm farther from home than I'd ever imagined possible, with no hope of escape. I close my eyes, leaning back against the chair. For some, while I can do nothing but sit there, seeing the darkness inside my head. Then an image seems to form, drawing my attention, my thoughts, piquing my curiosity. It's the image of a shadow kneeling in abject despair and humiliation, arms upraised to the impervious face of a goddess in stone. 8. The day passes slowly. Exhausted by the ebb and flow of fear and despair, I drift in and out of restless sleep. Occasionally, I rise from the chair and take a turn about the room. Once I even stop and look into the bathing chamber, eyeing the gently steaming, aromatic water. By day, sunlight pours through a skylight overhead, gleaming off the white walls and colorful tiles. The little globes of light float along the bottom of the pool, their brilliance dulled in the sunlight. I still can't decide whether or not they're living. I take a closer look at the silky white gown presented on the chair. The fabric is smooth beneath my fingertips, its folds shimmering with an unexpected iridescence. Professional curiosity aroused, I turn it inside out to examine the stitching, but can't find a seam. The gown may have simply sprung into being fully formed. It's exquisite, and it looks as though it would fit me rather well. I drop it on the floor and return to the bedroom, refusing to so much as look into the bathing chamber again. I'm not going to be won over by gifts and luxuries. The lord of this house can tempt me all he likes. It won't make me any less his prisoner. Eventually, the light cast through the window's colorful panes dims. The shadows deepen, and soon the room will be quite dark indeed. I sit in my chair, staring into the empty hearth where last night a fire had burned. How am I supposed to light a blaze? Simply speak it into being? I lean forward in my seat and whisper softly, "Light." Immediately, Shining white stones appear, and blue flames erupt around them, flickering bright and filling the room with a pale glow like moonlight. I settle back in my seat again, watching them burn. More time passes. Still, I sit here. The flames burn down eventually. Perhaps I should light them again, keep the fire going all night. Would it be enough to keep my bridegroom from visiting? He said I couldn't see him, after all, that we couldn't meet save at night when my fire was low. Could it be that simple to ward him off? Maybe, but... I tighten my grip on the chair arms. If I'm going to survive my time here, I need to show him that I won't be cowed. I can't hide. I can't shrink and tremble. I must face the master of this house, and then... And then... And then what? I whisper. My resolve wavers. Before I can think of a suitable answer, the door opens. I look up, see a dark silhouette, and look down again quickly, staring at the burning white stones. My heart races, and I struggle to maintain steady, rhythmic breathing. His sharp fey ears will certainly hear it if my breath catches, and I won't give him the satisfaction of knowing how badly he frightens me. Not if I can help it.
Good evening, m'lady,
rumbles the deep voice of my unseen groom. I clench my teeth hard and stare more intently into the blaze. A long pause, then a soft murmur of,
close.
I hear the swish of the door shutting. The wall is solid once more. Ears pricked, I listen to the sound of his footsteps and the drag of heavy robes as he crosses the room. From the tail of my eye, I glimpse an indistinct form pausing at the little table where the jewels are displayed. Another silence follows.
Do you not like my gifts?
He says at last. I almost flash a glare his way. But no, I won't look at him. I won't speak to him. Not until I'm ready. He waits a polite interval. Then I hear a little wordless grunt, followed by a jumbled noise, as though he's pushed the jewels off to one side. Several of them land with small thunks on the floor. After that, a clatter, a vaguely familiar sound, like porcelain and silver. The next moment, a smell washes over me, a hearty, meaty, savory smell that makes my traitorous stomach growl. I slap a hand against my middle as though I can physically make it stop. This is going to be harder than I thought.
My servants tell me you have not eaten.
I listen intently to another series of gentle clattering sounds. Is he serving up something? Despite my efforts to resist, my gaze swivels slightly to one side, and I spy a bowl, a ladle, a spoon. My mouth waters. The shadowy figure turns, and a shallow, gilt-edged bowl slides into my line of view. Cuts of meat still on the bone lay in an elegant display, drizzled with dark sauce and garnished with leafy herbs and slices of some sweet-smelling fruit I don't recognize. It's beautiful, a feast for the eye, and the smells rising to tickle my nostrils make me dizzy with hunger. I set my jaw and grip my hands tightly in my lap. I'm not hungry. Unseen eyes watch me closely. I can almost feel them narrowing.
Is the meal not to your liking?
I shake my head. I won't eat.
I instructed my people to prepare dishes similar to those you would find in your own world. They may have struggled somewhat to fulfill the order, but I will speak to them if you wish. They desire to please, even if they...
I said I won't eat. I flick a glance up to the figure holding out the platter. He stands in such a way that I cannot even see his hand. When he said I couldn't see him, did he truly mean not so much as a fingernail? I store that thought away for later consideration and direct a glare up at the dark space where a head might be. I'm not a simpleton. I know the games you people play. I won't fall so easily. A long, contemplative silence follows. Then the plate withdraws from the firelight, and the shadowy form returns to the table. I listen to the clatter of spoons and bowls, see a cover being lowered. It blocks off some of the smell, much to my relief. It was going to drive me mad with hunger. Then my dark bridegroom moves to the place across the hearth from me. He takes a seat in the empty chair. I feel him watching me, and I look back, determined not to drop my gaze.
"The food is not poisoned," he says at last. "Neither is it enchanted. You are my wife. You may safely partake of all that I own, for it is yours. My servants are instructed to treat you with the utmost courtesy and respect, as is due the Lady of Orokin."
I swallow painfully. I am not the Lady of Orokin, and I am not your wife.
According to the laws of claiming and choosing.
Yes, yes, you went over all that last night. But I don't see how even your fey laws can govern in this instance. Coercion and choice are not the same, after all.
Coercion?
Yes. What else would you call it? When your people stood outside my door and told me they had my sister in their clutches. What else was I to do? What choice did I have but to step through my door?
Did they...
A pause. Then I hear a noise, like a throat clearing.
Pardon me for asking, but did my people threaten your sister?
I open my mouth, shut it again. My memories of that horrible evening are a bit clouded. I remember the many voices telling me how sweet my sister was, how they loved to dance with her, how pretty they thought she was. And there had been a scream, but I can recall no actual threat being spoken. A sick sensation coils in my stomach. I sag suddenly back in my chair, feeling weak. No, I whisper at last. No, they didn't threaten her. Not overtly.
And they made no bargain with you? Set no terms for her release?
I shake my head numbly. I hear a long intake and slow release of breath.
In that case, the terms of the claiming and choosing are still honored. So long as they made no threat and offered no bargain, your choice to cross the threshold, by law, constitutes a choice.
I drop my chin. For the first time in a very long while, I taste a foul word rising in my throat, struggling to get out. Mother always said that expletives are a coward's way of expressing emotion, so I swallow it back. I'm no coward. I was still tricked, I say instead, my voice thick.
Yes.
There's a dangerous rumble in the darkness, like a growl.
Yes, you were. And for that, I shall have words with my people. I swear it. They will suffer for their insolence.
I shoot a quick glance at the shadow. In my mind's eye, I see again the green woman, burbling and gentle, leading me back through the baffling corridors of this massive house. I don't want anyone hurt, I say at length. After all, I suppose they were only trying to fulfill your orders. Another long silence follows this, then a little huff, a sound of surprise.
You are a strange one, m'lady.
There's surprise in his voice. He doesn't sound displeased, merely baffled.
I had not known humans were like you.
I blink and duck my head again. Like me? What do you mean?
I mean...
He hesitates as though struggling to find the right words.
I suppose I mean... kind. Even now, angry as you are, you take no opportunity to give vent to your anger. But then again... perhaps you do not yet understand.
The shadow shifts. I get the impression he's leaning toward me.
Whatever you ask of me, if it is within my power, I shall do for you. Command me to punish my people for their trickery, and they shall suffer the direst of consequences. Command me to flay their hides with iron rods, and it shall be done. Command me to make them apologize, and I shall send them to grovel before you on their bellies to plead your forgiveness. Such is the power you have over me as my wife. Do you understand?
The darkness of the chamber seemed suddenly so much deeper and colder. Until that moment, I hadn't realized just how menacing that voice was, or how carefully its owner modulated its tones to make them gentle, palatable to my ears. I'd always known the Fae were dangerous, but until now, I hadn't grasped exactly what that danger meant. Now, listening to my unseen bridegroom's voice, I feel as though I hear the voice of a tiger. Not cruel, exactly. A tiger is not cruel as it follows the impulses of its nature. Yet it is utterly dangerous, an apex predator of the night. I don't want anyone hurt, I repeat, speaking softly lest he hear my trembling. And I don't want any groveling, I only want to go home. I watch the shadow shift as he leans back in his seat.
You will go home. The first day of our marriage term is now complete. 1 year from now, I shall personally deliver you to your father's door.
I close my eyes, determined not to let hot tears slip through my lashes. When I'm certain I have control over my voice, I say, In that case, there is something else I want.
Name it.
He sounds relieved, as though the very hope of being able to grant some wish of mine removes a burden from his shoulders. I clench my jaw and speak through grinding teeth. I want to know that my sister is unharmed.
My people would not hurt her. They honor the pledge.
Are you certain of that? I lift my head, staring into the darkness where he sits. You didn't even know what means they used to lure me from my home. Are you so sure of your people, or your control over them? My words hang in the air between us, ringing a little too loud and a little too vicious. I twist a fold of my skirt between my hands, but refuse to drop my gaze. Let the monster snarl. Let him rage at me for my insolence. I won't back down. I've lived in the same house as a monster all my life. A monster who beat me, who despised me, who treated me like less than nothing. And over the years, I learned just how strong I could be, how deep the wellspring of my courage ran. The shadow stands. I choke back a startled yelp as he moves suddenly, his cloak sweeping to block out the light of the fire. Then he is on his knees before me, as he was the night before, when he held my hands between his, whispered his name, and kissed me softly 3 times. I try to stand, but he catches my hands again now, and I freeze at his touch.
Valera,
he says, my name soft on his lips.
I swear to you, I will find your sister and ensure her well-being.
I draw a careful breath. I want proof.
I will bring proof.
Proof I can believe. Something only she can give me.
You shall have it.
I want your vow that you won't trick me. The shadow of his head bows.
Speak my name.
What?
Speak my name. Use it to command me. You will feel the power go out from you into me. You'll know that your command will be honored to the utmost of my ability.
I swallow. An odd sort of reluctance twists my heart. I don't want to possess his name. I don't want either the power or the intimacy such possession means. I don't want there to be anything shared between us. But just now, I need every weapon available to me. And this, I know without a doubt, is a weapon unlike any other. Aralos, I whisper. His hands clasped around mine tense. I feel the edge of long nails and have to stop myself from flinching and pulling away. Aralos, I said again, with more force this time. I command you to find my sister and bring back proof that she is all right. And... My mind spins with all the things I suddenly wish I could communicate to Brielle. All the warnings, all the injunctions, all the advice and love and wishes. I suck in both lips and taste the salt of my own tears. Let her know that I am well, that she must not try to find me, that she must wait for me. My voice gives out in a sob. Yanking free of his grasp, I cover my face, pressing the heels of both hands into my eyes in a vain attempt to stop the flow of tears. He remains kneeling before me, a huge, solid presence. Several times I think he tries to speak, but each time he stops himself. At last, he stands.
You have my word, Valera. Do you believe me? Do you feel the truth between us?
I shudder, but when I search, I feel an odd something. A sensation like a trembling wire anchored down inside of me, stretching across the void between souls. Am I right to believe that a second anchor sinks deep into the heart of this dark, terrible being standing before me? That the wire stretches between us, a profoundly real, if utterly inexplicable, bond. Aralas. I speak the name silently, my lips moving without sound. The sensation quickens, the invisible, connecting wire vibrating slightly. Perhaps it's my imagination, but no, I don't think I could imagine something like that. I believe you. I lift my head, my face damp with tears, and blink into the darkness where his face should be. I believe you, and now I want you to go. He stands and bows. I hear the movement of his robes and feel the grace of the gesture I cannot see.
M'lady,
he murmurs. The next moment, his footsteps sound on the hard floor as he crosses the room. The door in the wall opens, and he is visible there in silhouette, huge and inscrutable. I watch the outline of a hand reach up to grip the doorway.
The food is safe for you to eat.
I watch his head turn, catch a glimpse of a hard profile, but only for a moment.
I understand that you do not trust me. I cannot blame you, but I hope you will eat even so.
With this, he steps from the room. The door closes behind him. For a time, I sit huddled in my chair, my arms wrapped tight around my middle, trying to stop my body from trembling. Then, with a growled, "Fine then," I spring up and cross to the little table. I fumble in the dark, find the lid, and lift it, breathing deep as a cloud of delicious steam rises to my nose. Perhaps the meal is enchanted. Perhaps it's poisoned. Perhaps I'll regret it come dawn. I eat every last bite anyway. 9. It's difficult to determine the passage of time in this new world. When I come groggily awake in my chair, my stomach still knotted and tight after my large meal of the night before, I guess it's already several hours past dawn. But the daylight shines through so much colored glass that I can't be certain. I sit up, feeling dull and stupid, but less frightened. That's something. My fear is still there, coiled into a little knot and tucked down deep in my gut where I can find it if I prod at it. Otherwise, I'm more tired than anything. Hearing a tentative knock, I sit bolt upright, blinking hard to drive lingering sleepiness from my eyes. Who's there? I call. Is it my so-called husband? No, he wouldn't come in daylight. Would he? Besides, he promised he would find Brielle. Surely that endeavor will take him away from this house for a while at least. A lilting burble reaches my ear, muffled through the wall. I get up and cross the room. Putting my ear against the wall, I listen to that voice climb up and down the scales as it rattles on in its strange, fluid language. It ends on a questioning lilt. I chew the inside of my cheek. The green woman hadn't seemed at all threatening yesterday, and it's awfully quiet and lonely in this room by myself. I step back from the wall. "Open," I say. The wall obeys, and the door slides back. The naked, willowy woman stands in the doorway, a covered tray in her hands. She smiles at me, displaying an overabundance of sharp teeth. I have to wonder if smiles are a natural expression of fey women of her kind, or if she's trying to make herself more approachable to a human. The little antennae wobble uncertainly, and the woman lifts her tray. "Oh, yes, come in." I step back, ushering the woman through. I indicate the table of jewels and the tray containing the remains of last night's meal. I suppose you can put that down there." The woman trills and chirrups. Shifting her tray to one hand, she uses the other to tidy up the table with quick, graceful movements. She's so swift and efficient. I wonder if she's using a sort of magic. She also gathers up the little necklaces and bracelets tumbled on the floor and adds them to the pile on the other side of the table. Then she sets down her tray and turns another toothy smile my way. "Yes, thank you." I approach a little timidly. I'm not used to being waited on like this. Certainly not by someone quite so odd. And naked. The woman waggles her antennae and says something else in her strange voice while lifting the lid. I blink and take a step back, startled. The green woman, her smile vanishing, flips the lid over and looks down at the tray. A little bat-eared man sits in the middle of an empty bowl, licking his fingers with a long, purple tongue. A dab of what looks like porridge sits on his head like a white, soppy hat, and his belly is fat and distended between his two scrawny legs. He grins up at the green woman and wiggles his ears at her before sending me a sly wink. The green woman shrieks, throws the lid and the tray of empty dishes down on the floor in a terrible clatter of scattered and broken dishware, and lunges for the little man. He dodges, but isn't quite fast enough. The green woman catches him by one huge ear, and he hollers a stream of squeaky, garbled words. I don't need to understand the language to recognize expletives when I hear them. Enraged, the green woman wraps her long fingers around the little man's throat, turns him upside down, and begins smashing his head into the table. The jewels on one end jump and fall in a stream of glittering stones, and the platter with the empty bowl tips and smashes on the floor, adding broken shards of porcelain to the overall mess. "Seven gods!" I cry, leaping at the green woman and grabbing her arm. "Oh, seven gods save us! What are you doing? Don't kill him! It's just porridge!" The green woman hisses, her antennae sticking up straight and quivering with rage. The little man, gripped upside down in her fist, shakes his head, blinks goggly eyes up at me, then spits out another expletive and waggles his ears again. The green woman, driven to new extremes of rage, whirls on her toes and nimbly springs to the wall where she resumes beating the creature's head in. "Stop!" I take a step, pause, then draw myself up tall. "I command you to stop!" The green woman freezes, her arm in mid-swing. She looks back at me, her black eyes narrow and resentful. The little man sticks out his long, purple tongue and wiggles it at her, making her hiss again. "Put him down," I say. "Gently." The last word comes out too late. The green woman merely uncurls her fingers and lets the man drop head first onto the hard floor. For a moment, he lies spread eagle, stunned. Then he pops upright, twirls in place, and offers an elaborate bow to me, made all the more ridiculous by the sight of his bare, bony little bottom sticking up in the air. He rights himself and dances a jig before dashing into the fireplace. He's up the chimney and out of sight in a wink. The green woman looks sadly at the broken dishes. Little mewling noises vibrate in her throat. Is she crying? Don't worry, I say, putting out a reassuring hand, but not quite daring to touch her leathery green arm. I wasn't really hungry. But if you want to help me, I could use a wash. The woman tilts her head, antennae twisting. I pluck at the front of my dress, which is rather grimy now after several days without changing. You know, wash? I frown slightly. I could have sworn I heard you and your friend speaking my language outside that night. Or was that a spell you cast to make me think I heard you? I'd like some water, please. Clean water. I mime washing my face. At this, the green woman's antennae perk up. She takes hold of my hand and, burbling cheerfully, leads me across the room. I guess where we're going even before the door to the bathing chamber opens. Oh, no. I pull my hand free. No, I have no desire to submerge myself. A wash basin and a cloth will be fine. The woman either doesn't hear or doesn't understand. She dances into the bathing chamber, beckoning enthusiastically. I creep reluctantly to the doorway and look inside, watching how the green woman moves about the space, picking up and setting down the various bottles of ointments, the combs and brushes, the woven cloths. She finds the white gown dropped on the floor and plucks it up, clucking and shaking her head. Then she tosses the garment across the empty chair and, much to my surprise, dives into the pool. She whisks around under the water, nimble as a fish, swimming the whole circumference 3 times before coming up for air. She tosses her little tendril ringlets back from her dark eyes and chitters her teeth happily, beckoning me. I step into the room and peer cautiously over the edge of the pool. My kind don't bathe in groups as a rule. The woman blinks at me and chitters again. Her own nakedness bothers her so little that she must find my modesty both baffling and amusing. When I firmly shake my head, however, she slides up out of the water, shakes herself off, and pads dripping to the table of bottles and soaps. She selects one, unstoppers the bottle, and holds it under my nose. It smells heavenly, sweeter than roses, deep and somehow plumy. I can't repress a sigh of approval. Pleased, the woman chortles and proceeds to pour the contents of the bottle into the bath. The water foams and bubbles, filling the air with more of that delicious aroma. Beneath the bubbles, the water turns a vivid purple. I pinch my lips together and glance at the green woman. She nods and waves her antennae encouragingly. Oh, all right, I cry, pulling at the fastenings of my gown. All right, you win. The bath is beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. 7 gods. How long has it been since I'd bothered to drag the old copper tub onto the kitchen hearth back home, fill it with water that all too soon went from scalding to tepid, and crammed myself into it? I can't remember. And it's been positively years since I used the last of the hidden stash of Mother's soft, scented soaps. Years since I'd resorted to rubbing my skin down with hard lumps of lye soap or simply scraping it with a pumice stone. This is pure bliss by comparison. The pool is deepest at its center, almost reaching my chin, but is shallow enough for me to sit down along the edges. I glide around it, wading through the aromatic bubbles. Several times, the glowing baubles under the water bump against my feet. They are unexpectedly slimy and a bit squishy, and I yelp the first time, but I get used to them quickly enough. If they are living creatures, they're gentle and seem happy to trail around behind me in the water, like a trio of spherical glowing puppies. After I've splashed a while, I catch the green woman's eye. She sits with her legs dangling in the pool and motions me to her, holding up a comb and another bottle of ointment. I obey and allow the green woman to work the comb through the knots and tangles of my hair, then massage sweet-smelling oil into my scalp. It's strange to be waited on, but I could get used to it. At last, combed, oiled, and smelling of exotic flowers, I climb from the bath, wrap my body in a soft towel the green woman hands to me, and look around for my dress. It's a shame to put that dirty old thing on while my skin feels so silky and clean. But, I frown. Where is it? The green woman blinks at me and burbles questioningly. Don't play coy. I wrap the towel a little tighter around myself. Where is my dress? What did you do with it? With a wave of one hand, as though motioning me to wait, the green woman darts around the pool. She returns, holding the shimmering white garment in both hands and offers another of her disconcerting, toothy grins. I look at the gown. It's beautiful. Undeniably beautiful. And it would feel so much better to put on something lovely and clean like that rather than to struggle into my old rags. But it feels wrong. Wrong to indulge in these luxuries, to enjoy these comforts. Like giving up. No. I shake my head, then hesitate. Issuing commands makes me feel uncomfortable, as if I'm playing at being someone I'm not. But what else can I do? Bring me my dress. Now. If you please. The green woman's eyes narrow, an expression of displeasure. With a little sniff through her slitted nostrils, she flounces out of the bathing chamber, returning soon after with my old dress draped over her arm. It's been washed, I note at once. Washed and pressed, and a little tear in the seam of the right sleeve is mended with stitches so tiny they look as though they've been woven into the warp and weft of the fabric itself. The undergown is pristine, whiter than it was the day I first wore it. Thank you, I say, and clothe myself under the green woman's resentful gaze. Once I'm clad, I allow her to style my hair in an elaborate arrangement of coils and braids. This seems to please her, and when she's through, she leads me to a tall, etched mirror standing against one wall in the bedchamber. I look. My somber reflection blinks back at me. The same hollow-eyed, scrawny, sallow-skinned girl I've always been. Only now there's a slight flush to my cheeks that hasn't been there in a long while. My hair, though far too elegantly styled to go with my simple dress, looks shiny and healthy. One coiling strand escaping to fall across my shoulder in a calculatedly fetching manner. The green woman knows what she's doing, that's for sure. Very well, I say softly, meeting my own gaze in the glass. You're here for a year. A year. My stomach pitches, but I tighten my jaw and speak firmly. You're going to make the best of it. And maybe you can find a way home sooner, if you're careful. The green woman appears in the glass, peering over my shoulder. She blinks innocently. Did she understand what I just said? It's hard to guess. I'm hungry, I tell her firmly. The green woman flashes her teeth and takes my hand. She leads me to the door in the wall, which opens at no command that I can discern. We step out into the corridor, and the woman turns right, tugging me after her, leading me through the patches of colored light on the floor. I look up at the windows as we pass them. Yesterday, I'd not taken time to notice the images rendered in glass and lead. Now I catch only brief glimpses of figures, men, women, and monsters. Fantastic landscapes of mountains and valleys, majestic palaces. I think I spot the image of the same man appearing in each of the windows, but I'm not certain. Perhaps there's a story being told here, spread down the length of the corridor. Perhaps I should take the time to look at it. Later. For now, my attention is diverted as the green woman sweeps back the curtains at the end of the corridor and leads me out into the courtyard. The long feasting table crawls with movement. My eyes widen in surprise. Dozens and dozens of little naked men with enormous ears run up and down, bouncing from chair to chair, shrieking and swearing and singing in their odd little squeaky voices. The green woman roars at the sight and, dropping my hand, throws herself at the creatures, swiping at them with her long-fingered hands. She catches several of them with good sound slaps and sends them flying through the air. Others dodge and dance around her feet, leaping to the height of her head to stick their long tongues out at her and flap their ears. It isn't long before several of the little men catch sight of me hanging back behind the curtains. A cry goes up among them, and they swarm my way. I don't have time to react before they're surrounding me, pulling at the edges of my skirt, linking arms and dancing in circles around me. Several of them leap up to my eye level, offering me pastries and fruits. "Thank you," I gasp and hold out a hand. A delighted little man drops his offering into my palm, while the others shriek and seethe with jealousy before redoubling their efforts. They spring like grasshoppers, up and down, shoving delicacies at me. One intrepid fellow tries to stuff a whole pastry into my open mouth. All right, settle down," I cry. The unintentional command works like magic. The little men scatter, vanishing under the table like scuttling bugs. The green woman stomps her foot down hard on one, which lets out an angry bleat. When she lifts her foot, it pops right back up and keeps on running, none the worse for wear, vanishing with the others. Soon the whole courtyard is still and silent. If I didn't know any better, I'd believe the green woman and I were the only living creatures in the whole massive house. "Well," I exclaim. There seems to be nothing else to say, so I shake my head and say it again. "Well." The green woman ushers me to a chair. Despite the madness and mayhem, the table still holds a fine display of pastries and fine fruits, breads and cheeses. The green woman pours a large serving of red wine into a jewel-edged goblet, but I opt to drink only water. I also choose the simplest of the foods presented to me: a bit of cheese, a bite of bread, a fruit that looks at least similar to an apple, though its flavor is more sour than sweet. When I've finished eating, I'm surprised to realize that the green woman is gone. I didn't know when she'd silently slipped away. An oppressive silence hangs over the courtyard, interrupted only by the distant murmur of water. I rise and stand a moment, uncertain. The fear still coiled tight in my gut begins to stir, to uncurl. No, I have no time for fear. I must be sensible about things and try to take charge of my circumstances. "You need to learn,"